With Trump's win, says Israel's finance minister, Bezalel Smotrich, the time has come to annex parts of the West Bank. After all, Trump has told Netanyahu to take care of business quickly, which is music to the Israeli government's ears. That's like a gang leader's order to his henchmen to get rid of the bodies. Netanyahu is doing just that. I'm Mel Gertoff of the Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, November 19, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Mel Gertoff and David Rosenberg. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Tegadoff, Isabel Charlet, Edwin J. Vieira, Antonia Gonzalez, Eric Galatas, Suzanne Potter, and Mike Moan. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Leuschner. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in depth.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM.
You are listening to KBOO News in Depth, an innovative, patient-founded, patient-run mental health and addiction program at the McGill University Health Center in Montreal that some psychiatrists thought needed to be ended has been shut down. Jesse Freestein is a documentary filmmaker and cinematographer who made a film about the program. He spoke with KBOO contributor David Rosenberg.
The clinic is totally shut down at this point?
Yeah, they've been kicked out. They received a 4-sentence email saying that they had to leave, and all attempts to get an answer to the questions of why the decision was made or how the decision was made were not responded to. And then the few journalists that are left working in the media here, the patients and the former patients that are coordinating Recovery Transition Program received an email this summer while most of the journalists were on vacation. 4-sentence email telling them that their program had been shut down and they had to leave, which put an end to 7 years of incredible amount of healing that was happening in this mental health institution.
What was the official name of the program?
It's the Recovery Transition Program. And basically it was patients, some from addictions program, some from schizophrenia program, and some from different mood disorders and bipolar disorder and things like this. And they realized that basically how these institutions work, I'm pretty sure all over North America, is the goal is stabilization. So you get admitted either to an inpatient clinic or an outpatient clinic. You go through a program, and then once you're considered stabilized, you're basically shown the door. You get a kind of a list of maybe a few community resources, but often those are all used up. And so there was a few different kind of patients that were in this situation where they felt kind of unprepared to jump right back into the real world, you know, and without any further accompaniment. And they decided to kind of pull on inspiration from a few different models and develop something called the Recovery Transition Program, which would peer people who were further along in their recovery with people that were just getting out of these programs that had just been basically declared stable. And they had an incredible result. And because I think the program was started so organically and that the founders themselves were in exploration mode, it really grew to involve things that I've never seen in a program like this before. I found out about the program myself because I was doing some research for a different project at McGill Hospital, McGill being the largest English language university in our city. And I ran into somebody who invited me to come to a documentary film screening at the psychiatric hospital. And I said, wait, who's organizing a documentary film screening at the psychiatric hospital? I said, oh, it's the RTP, it's the patient. And, you know, as a documentary filmmaker, I'm always interested when I see documentary films being used as a tool to create understanding or to gather people together. Public documentary screenings always fascinate me. And then this one was doubly so given the context of it being organized by patients in the hospital. And so I went, and then when I was there, I met some of the organizers, and they said, are you coming to the talent show? What talent show? Oh, we're having a talent show at the hospital. Patients are going to be showing off their different talents. And I said, of course. And so I came to that. And, you know, as many people are aware, California has its own stories of this, that there's definitely an overlap between creativity and mental illness or mental challenges. And there were some incredible performances at this talent show. And it was a level of joy that you definitely don't associate with a psychiatric hospital. And it was actually then that I got my first taste of the resistance to this program, which is that there's a certain percentage of the psychiatrists at the hospital that really didn't like this program.
Do they feel threatened because they feel they have expertise and that these people aren't qualified to take care of themselves, that sort of thing?
So that's absolutely part of it. And I met one psychiatrist that was in the film, actually, because he talked about he thought it was a really bad idea at first. But then once it had started, he said, okay, I'm going to send one of my patients to go through the training to become a peer mentor and become a peer mentor, and I'm going to find out, you know, how it works, and through that experience. And he came out of it as one of the greatest champions of the program, as he came to realize that there are things that peers can do that professionals can't, in the sense that people will be more honest and transparent when they're talking to somebody who's been through the same thing as them.
I remember that there was a sort of peer counseling movement in the 70s and 80s. I don't know if it was existing in Canada as well. You know, that idea that just what you said, that people who've gone through the same experience can be more helpful at times.
I think it's a logical step. I mean, the whole, all the 12-step programs channel this energy, AA and NA and all the different A's, all the anonymous programs. But this one was going bigger than that. I mean, those programs tend to always stay on the topic of the illness, you know? And I think what the RTP unlocked was the role that kind of loneliness plays in exacerbating or perhaps even being the source of illness, of whatever we want to call the opposite of well-being. And I think a lot of us experienced that during the pandemic, was whatever, you know, lingering anxieties or bad mental habits or bad mental hygiene that we have, and I think we all have something, got a little bit exacerbated when we were lonely. And so I think what the RTP did was get people at a time where they really needed it to focus on other stuff. They started publishing a magazine, for example, three times a year, which included arts and poetry and journalism. The patients would go around the hospital interviewing psychiatrists and for the magazine, and like the amount of joy that people got out of publishing their work and this working together to get this thing published and printed, it put people on a totally different project, a different mission than just, you know, picking apart and their specific challenges, you know.
How many people are we talking about? How many people were involved in the program?
There was definitely hundreds over its existence. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but at any given meeting or gathering, you'd have like in the dozens. But the goal of the program is that it is a transition program. are staying in it for 7 years, it's probably not working very well. The success is in the people that are back out in society, feeling good about themselves and having developed some skills within the program and some pride and self-esteem.
When you're talking about this, it somehow made me think of that book and that movie, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, you know, where the patients started to have some fun and then the authorities came in and kind of smashed it and made sure that things returned to normal.
My experience since in the last few months has literally been some sort of dark remix of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and The Shining, because Jack Nicholson is definitely starring in this movie of what has happened in the past few months. I'll share just a few things. So I've done a Freedom of Information request and gotten some of the emails that were being sent around before the program was canceled because we couldn't get any information. None of the upper administration was giving us interviews, and the few things that they said in the media were contradictory.
So Freedom, you used the U.S. Freedom of Information Act to get information?
No, it's there's a Canadian one. It's called ATIP, Access to Information.
I see, okay.
But it's basically the same concept. And in that process, for example, you know, I saw meeting notes and emails with psychiatrists asking that somebody investigate whether or not this magazine that they publish is necessary. You know, and like just the terminology. I remember once meeting with a psychiatrist that ostensibly was in favor of the program, and they asked me what I was going to be filming that week. I said, "Oh, I'm going to be filming the book club on Wednesday." So they would have they had a book club where they would all read a book together and then you know respond to it. And the psychiatrist said to me, "Oh, we're going to get that book club shut down." And I said, "Why would you get the book club shut down? People love the book club." And she said to me, she said, "Well, this isn't a library; it's a hospital." Honestly, I left this thinking that some of the sickest people in the building were the psychiatrists. Another time, another psychiatrist called me in for a meeting, said I had to come, it was very urgent, and I showed up, and I was a bit frustrated because I had to travel the other side of the city for this meeting. She won't even tell me what it's about, and then all she said to me was, "I don't know what they're telling you," and I was, "Who's they?" Like, the patient. Okay, I don't know what they're telling you, but just remember that, you know, they're not like us, they're very sick, and I came out of this just sort of feeling like this is a vocation that I'm not saying all psychiatrists are bad. I've met many very, very cool and open-minded ones in this process. But there is a certain personality, much like bullies like to be cops, you know, something like there's some type of person that gets attracted to psychiatry in particular.
These people are not R.D. Langs or Thomas Sotts or those kind of people.
No, definitely not. Honestly, some of the conversations, you felt like you were talking to like a Disney villain.
Yeah.
You know, where it's like, okay, well, what's their motivation here? It seems like they just don't like seeing people happy in the building. You know what I mean? Like, it just, like, it wasn't, and they really struggled to explain, and it was always couched in terms of, like, security. Well, you know, harm could happen. Well, what harms are you worried about? You know, and it really never came, because I'm looking at this, you know, I'm a big believer in the doctrine of Jimi Hendrix. If a 6 turns out to be 9, I don't mind. We're all looking at this program and seeing a 6. We're seeing a bunch of people getting healthy, you know, getting off the drugs that you're prescribing them, for example, you know, like getting quite well and having, for the first time in years, in many of their cases, like real joy and finding real meaning to get up in the morning. And that stuff is contagious and it spreads. And so that's what we're seeing. So if you were trying to tell me that this thing that we see as a 6 is actually a 9, it's actually a negative, it's actually bad in some way, I mean, that's on you to explain it to us. You can't just say, "I'm a psychiatrist, I have a PhD after my name, you don't, let me tell you what's going on." And that's the kind of thinking that we ran into over and over and over again.
Are there other, or have you heard of other such programs like this in Canada?
Part of the reason I got involved was that they were trying to spread it. So, I mean, these similar programs, at least at the level of peer mentoring, exist in many different forms. But most of them, that when they're inside the institution, the person that they call a peer mentor is usually somebody who has a college degree in something, you know, in the social work, psychology world. And maybe they have, you know, lived some experiences in the past many times, but now they're like a paid employee who sees, I don't know how many people a day, 4 or 8 or something like this. Whereas in the case of this program, I'm sure it exists, but I've yet to run into it. This is you know, people getting paired up, like they have one or two people. When you're a peer mentor, you have like one or two people that you're seeing once or twice a week, totally voluntarily. And it creates connections that I don't think like a paid staff member creates. You know, when you're seeing eight people a day, you're actually encouraged to turn off your empathy a little bit, you know, so that you don't get too taking on the world's problems, you know, on your shoulders all the time. Whereas when it's like a one-to-one thing and nobody's being paid and there's nobody has a college degree, it's not, there's no hierarchy here either in terms of credentials or who's getting paid to be here, who isn't, who's got an office with their name on it that we're sitting in. That hierarchy doesn't exist. And so it really is a one-to-one connection. And then you add on to that all these other things that I've mentioned, the book club, the talent shows, the film screenings, the magazine. You know, they were organizing workshops. People were encouraged to organize workshops for things that brought them joy or helped them get through tough times or whatever. Like, for example, there was one person, Raphael, who got really interested in Buddhism and really dedicated themselves to Buddhist meditation. And they started giving a workshop on Buddhist meditation. People loved it so much that they actually instituted at the beginning and end of every meeting, they would have a couple minutes of silence. And I mean, like 2 to 3 minutes of silence. And it was my first time ever seeing that happen in a meeting. You know, it's okay, we're going to have a meeting, talk about this thing. Okay, we're doing our silence. And they would just sit in the room in quiet. And then everyone would take a deep breath. And there was just like a peace. And they had some of the most productive meetings. And people would talk about how this was in large part due to the influence of Raphael's workshop.
Do you know if the people who were involved in the program are still in contact?
There are some that have, you know, like everything, when a bomb goes off in the building, different people react in different ways. And there are some that are organizing to try and find a new space, try and get together outside the hospital, and I know they're doing that. There are others that have disappeared to a large degree, kind of fallen off the map. And I'd say there's a few different reactions out there.
Any new word from McGill at all about this program?
Yeah, I mean, one of the other things that's come out in this whole experience for me is just some of the impacts of the gutting of our journalistic institutions. I was sending total packages to journalists everywhere across the city. You know, look into this. Here's the door you have to knock on. They're not answering my emails. They're not answering my phone calls. They're not talking to us. Can you please go in there and find out why this happened, how this happened, et cetera, and what their plan is, considering that they've canceled this thing, for what they think the people in the program should do next, you know? And it's been incredibly difficult to get a journalist on the case. I've been calling up personal contacts, all kinds of things, to try to get somebody with an institutional backing that they'll feel they have to answer to. And the few times that has happened, it's usually been a short radio interview where they basically say contradictory things and the journalist is kind of unprepared because they're overworked to challenge them on it, and we still don't get a clear answer. And the other thing I would say that I've noticed is the cowardice of academia. I have gotten very many emails from psychiatrists and, you know, professors and people within the institution, you know, encouraging me to continue on. You know, this cause is just, this is a total disgrace. You know, I can't believe this is happening. And I write them back saying, can you please contact the head of psychiatry? Can you please contact the head of the mental health mission? Can you let your opposition be known, please? And, I'm too busy. Well, you weren't too busy to write me to encourage me to keep going. And I'm basically asking for like the same number of characters and words for you to send to somebody who can do something about it, you know, to help us in some way. And it's been a total absence of people willing to stick their neck out.
Is there something in McGill University's history that would suggest that they would have acted the way they have in regard to the patient-led mental health recovery program?
The building where the patients have this program is the same building. It's a very creepy mansion. At one point, it was the largest house or largest private residence in all of Canada. And then it got donated to the mental health hospital. And it's called Raven's Crag. And it was here in the 60s and 70s where the MK Ultra experiments happened. And so it literally everything that I've been describing, the book club, the magazine, you know, all these peer mentor meetings, all these things were happening in the same building where just a couple generations ago, CIA money was financing people of the same profile, people suffering from the same situation were being tortured. So they were being given massive doses of LSD while they were being electroshocked. They were being kept awake for sometimes, 15 days. And the whole plan was to see whether or not you could erase the memory of somebody and then reprogram them. And so, yeah, the CIA was using a front group to fund these experiments. And so it's in the same building where people were completely robbed of their dignity, and then people in that same profile a couple generations later have found, more dignity than perhaps had ever been seen in a mental institution that I'm aware of. And now this is where it feels like The Shining, where it's like there's something in that building that takes over the souls of people, and particularly psychiatrists, it seems like, and kind of turns them against the other people in the building. And that it seems to have cycled back again.
Are there psychologists on the staff as well? And if so, did they disagree with the ruling,
I didn't run into any psychologists in that building. I know obviously McGill has a psychology department, and there are psychologists around. But these are all psychiatrists.
And what sort of reputation does the McGill Mental Hospital have in Canada? Is it like very prestigious? Is it like, say, the Mayo Clinic in the U.S. for medicine?
I haven't seen the World News Report ranking of the mental health institutions, but it definitely is considered one of the go-to places. Definitely in the English language in Montreal, it's kind of the only player. And, we've got a couple hundred thousand Anglophones here in Montreal. And it definitely has some credibility. It also, McGill is famous for its neuroscience department, and they definitely do some experiments involving patients and things. It's known for its research for sure in that area as well.
Anything else you want to add to what you said?
Yeah, I mean, there was this other wild moment that happened, which is, after they announced that the program was going to be canceled, the patients came to me. Like, the film had been finished 2 years ago, and it was just being used to send to other institutions to get them interested in the program and seeing what's going on. And so when the patients were informed that they had 1 month to vacate the premises and, were not given a meeting to question why and not told, what evaluation had happened or anything like this, they came to me. I'd finished the film a couple of years ago, and, what should we do? And I said, well, we've got this film, the original purpose was to send to other institutions, but we could do a public screening and invite politicians and media to come see it and try to draw attention to what's happening that way. And people got really excited. They're like, let's do it at the hospital. They had a graduation ceremony coming up for the next round of peer mentors that were going through the training program. And they were like, we'll do the graduation ceremony and screen the film. And that way, people can get a really clear look at what's being taken away here. And originally the administration agreed to have this screening. I went in and did the, 3 days before the screening, went in and did the tech test to make sure everything was working. And then I guess they got their hands on the press release that we sent out, where we pointed out certain facts, like that the annual budget for this program is $50,000 Canadian, which is something like 40,000 American or 35,000. And then we put that in perspective, just to give people a sense of, how that relates to other costs at the hospital. That's 15% or less than a sixth of the annual salary of the CEO of the hospital. And we had little, things like this in the press release. So I now know that that's what triggered the reaction from the institution, because of that, from the emails, which is that then immediately after that press release made the rounds or whatever inside the administration, they asked for a list of everybody that was going to become who were going to be coming to the screening. And we said, well, we didn't ask for an RSVP. We don't know who's coming. And then they said, okay, we're putting security at the door, and nobody who's not a volunteer or staff at the hospital will be allowed in the building that day. And so I wasn't even allowed to go to my own screening. So a lot of the patients went, and former mentors and mentees went, and there was somebody from the administration filming everybody who spoke. And then a few days later, just before they were coming to clean out their office, and in the office they had all the notes that mentors had taken during their meetings, and about a day before they were coming to pick up, and they had their training manuals and all these things, and a day before they were supposed to come in and pick all that stuff up to clean out their office, the administration raided their office and took everything. So there's just a lot of behavior going on that lends itself to a Jack Nicholson Hollywood movie. And because of the fact that we have very few on-staff journalists, there's just been no investigative work done to find out what's really happening, except for my few Freedom of Information requests and unanswered emails and unanswered phone calls.
Maybe there'll be a major film made about it, you know, with a broad Hollywood distribution someday.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, it's already been made. I told you, it's called "One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest." You identified it.
I mean, you know.
I get retired psychiatrists and people sort of sending me emails and things saying, "Well, I'll tell you what's going on." And the problem is that when there's silence like this from when an institution makes a decision like this, and there's this much silence and this much attempt to silence, it can't lead you anywhere else than to start hypothesizing, and that leads you into conspiracy theories about big pharma and, you know, and things like this. You know, or you're just left with, like, okay, you're Cruella De Vil, like you're a Disney villain who just couldn't stand seeing people smiling at the psychiatric hospital. This is a message to anyone running an institution. You need to explain why you do things, or else we're left to our own devices.
That was Montreal-based documentary filmmaker Jesse Freestin speaking with KABU contributor David Rosenberg about an innovative mental health and addiction program at the McGill University Health Center in Montreal. You've been listening to KABU News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. Thanks for being with us.
You are tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Do you love music but don't have the energy to find new stuff? Can't decide whether you want to hear indie rock or hip-hop, electronic music or singer-songwriters? Then tune into Another Late Night every first Saturday at 3 a.m. only on KBOO Community Radio, or stream online at kboo.fm/anotherlatenight. Where we've got it all.
Thank you.
KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the